My topic is the history and analysis of CIA complicity in the global drug trade. Tonight, I want to speak to you about the CIA's long history of ad hoc alliances with drug lords, one key reason why America has become trapped in an endless cycle of drugs and death in Afghanistan, a Sisyphean cycle from which there is no easy end or exit. Now, there are two, if you will, spatial dimensions that serve as the locus, the location, for these arm-length alliances. First, a metaphysical, covert netherworld inhabited by criminals and clandestine agencies, and second, the mountain rim of Asia. Let me turn first, very briefly, to this covert netherworld. Throughout the Cold War, the CIA used gangsters and warlords on continents across the globe, many of them drug dealers, to fight communism. Both criminals and covert agents share a unique ability to operate beyond the bounds of civil society, off the books, sub rosa, and as denizens of that invisible interstice that I call the covert netherworld, they frequently formed alliances. Second, the second spatial zone, the Asian mountain rim. In one of history's accidents, the Iron Curtain fell along the Asian opium zone at the start of the Cold War, a zone that stretches for 5,000 miles from Turkey to Thailand. To contain Soviet and communist expansion during the Cold War, the United States mounted covert operations to probe communism's soft southern underbelly. And for the past 60 years, the CIA fought a succession of secret wars along this mountain rim, in Burma during the 1950s, Laos during the 1960s, and Afghanistan from the 1980s to the present. In one of history's ironic coincidences, the Iron Curtain had also fallen along Asia's historic opium zone that stretches along that same 5,000 miles from Turkey to Thailand, drawing the CIA into ambiguous alliances with the region's highland warlords. These leaders exploited the CIA alliance to become drug lords, expanding opium production and exporting refined heroin. The agency tolerated such trafficking and, when necessary, blocked investigations. Since ruthless drug lords made effective anti-communist allies and heroin profits amplified their power, CIA agents, operating alone, half a world away from home, did not tamper with the requisites of success in such delicate operations. Let's turn to one of the first and most controversial of these incidents, the CIA covert war in Laos during the Vietnam War. In Asia, distance insulated the CIA from the consequences of such complicity. In Laos during the 1960s, the CIA battled communism with a secret army of 30,000 Hmong villagers, tough highlanders whose only cash crop was opium. When Hmong officers loaded opium on the CIA's airline Air America, and the Lao army's commander, our ally, opened the world's largest heroin laboratory, the agency was silent. In a secret 1972 report, the CIA's inspector general explained the agency's tolerance of drug trafficking by its local allies. Quote, "The past involvement of many of these officers in drugs is well known, yet their goodwill considerably facilitates the military activities of agency-supported irregulars." By 1971, 34%, according to a White House survey, of all U.S. soldiers serving in South Vietnam were heroin addicts, all supplied from laboratories operated by such CIA assets. When I went to Laos to investigate the traffic in 1971, the Lao Army commander graciously opened his opium account books for my inspection, but the U.S. mission Stonewall, denying that same Army commander was in any way involved in drugs. In Hmong Village, where we were investigating opium shipments on the CIA's Air America, CIA mercenaries ambushed my research team. A CIA operative threatened to murder my Lao interpreter unless I quit my investigation. When my book, The Politics of Heroin, was in press, the head of CIA covert operations pressured my publisher to suppress it, and the CIA's general counsel demanded deletions, excisions. After the book was published unaltered, CIA agents in Laos threatened my sources, pressing them to recant and convince the House Foreign Relations Committee that my allegations were baseless. Simultaneously, however, the CIA's inspector general conducted an internal investigation that confirmed the substance of my investigation. Amidst all this controversy, all these denials, by 1974, Southeast Asian syndicates were supplying a quarter of the U.S. demand with Golden Triangle heroin. But Asia was too remote for allegations of CIA complicity to pack any political punch, and the issue soon faded, denying the country a chance to censure and correct. But just 5 years later, in 1979, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and the Sandinistas seized Managua, the capital of Nicaragua, prompting two CIA operations with revealing similarities. During the 1980s, the CIA, working through Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence, spent about $3 billion to support the Afghan resistance. At the start of this covert war in 1979, the Afghan opium harvest was only 100 tons of raw opium annually, and this opium was sold in regional markets. There was no heroin production. Within 2 years, however, the Pakistan-Afghanistan borderlands became the world's top heroin producer, supplying 60% of America's demand. In Pakistan, addicts went from zero in 1979 to 1,200,000 just 6 years later. Again, CIA assets controlled this heroin trade. As guerrillas seized territory inside Afghanistan, they ordered peasant tax payments in opium. This opium was transported across the border, where Afghan leaders and local dealers operated hundreds of heroin laboratories under the protection of the CIA's ally, Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence. In May of 1990, after a decade of this complicity, as the operation was winding down, the Washington Post reported that a man named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the CIA's favorite asset, had received over $1 billion in U.S. aid, was also the region's leading heroin trafficker, operating a dozen labs along the Afghan-Pakistan border. In 1995, the former CIA director of the Afghan operation, a man named Charles Cogan, wrote an article admitting that they had sacrificed the drug war to fight the Cold War, offering a statement that reveals, I think, the agency's realpolitik calculus in dealing with drug lords. Let me quote. "Our main mission was to do as much damage as possible to the Soviets. We really didn't have the resources or the time to devote to an investigation of the drug trade. I don't think that we need to apologize for this. Every situation has its fallout. There was fallout in terms of drugs, yes, but the main objective was accomplished. The Soviets left Afghanistan." Again, distance insulated the CIA from political fallout of its alliances with the drug lords. Once the heroin left Pakistan, Sicilian mafia exported it to the United States, and yes, it's true, Sicilian immigrants, middle-aged couples who migrated to the United States, opened up a chain of pizza parlors from Boston, Massachusetts to Milton, Wisconsin. They distributed the heroines and local gangs sold it on the street. Not surprisingly, most ordinary Americans could not do the complex geopolitical equation between Afghan drug lords, Sicilian mafia, pizza parlors in town like Milton, Wisconsin, and the heroin on their streets. In Central America, however, simple proximity made the political fallout from the CIA's operation explosive. Proximity brought these operations to the attention of Congress. In the late 1980s, a subcommittee under Senator John Kerry, your senator, investigated the Contra cocaine links. His investigators established that four Contra-connected corporations hired by the State Department to fly humanitarian relief goods down to Central America were returning with cocaine as cargo. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration operative assigned to Honduras, a man named Mr. Thomas Zepeda, testified that his office had been closed in June 1983 since it was generating intelligence that the local Honduran military was involved in cocaine trafficking, thereby threatening the CIA's relationship with this key frontline force for the Contra War. In effect, agency operations had once again created another enforcement-free zone, just like the Afghan borderlands closed to investigations from outside agencies. In August of 1996, the San Jose Mercury News published an explosive expose that tried to go the next step, establishing a direct link between the Contra War in Central America and the distribution of drugs on the streets of the United States. In this story called The Dark Alliance, the San Jose Mercury News reported that a syndicate allied with Nicaragua's CIA-backed Contras delivered tons of cocaine to Los Angeles gangs during the 1980s, sparking a national media controversy and visible outrage among African Americans. To quiet this controversy among a key Democratic Party constituency, President Clinton sent his CIA director, John Deutsch, to South Central Los Angeles to stand up in front of 800 citizens from the hood in a site of the most brutal of the gang warfare. It's an extraordinary experience. It's on YouTube. I suggest you watch it. Seeing John Deutsch, this rather patrician scientist, confronted by members of the African-American community. Deutsch, in the midst of this meeting, denied any CIA complicity in drugs, but he did make a promise that as CIA director, he would order a full investigation. In early 1998, the CIA released Volume 1 of its investigative report, claiming that no CIA agents were personally involved in the traffic. Now, this was a charge that nobody had made, okay? And then the national press chimed in and said, right, case closed, no case to answer, CIA exonerated, next story. Then, after the Klieg lights were turned off and the media had gone away, in October of 1998, the CIA released Volume 2 of its investigative report, detailing, in extraordinarily detailed revelations, the CIA's close alliance with one of the Caribbean's major cocaine traffickers, a man named Alan Hyde, the godfather of the Bay Islands off Honduras. Starting on paragraph 913, the CIA report explained in 40 detailed paragraphs that followed how the CIA had protected Hyde from all criminal investigations from 1986 to 1992 in exchange for the use of his facilities to ship arms to the Contra rebels in Honduras. And although the CIA Inspector General posted this full report online on the CIA's website, there was no article in the national press about these revelations of a close alliance between the agency and the CIA's, the Caribbean's top cocaine smuggler. This agency's realpolitik alliance with drug lords may or may not have increased the flow of narcotics into the United States, but these alliances certainly left a deep reservoir of suspicion among African Americans that deepened this country's racial divide. These patterns of CIA complicity with drug lords have reemerged in Afghanistan to undercut the current U.S. war effort in that country. In each of the three wars the United States has fought in Afghanistan over the past 30 years, opium has played an invisible yet critical role in shaping the outcome of these three conflicts. Now, during the Cold War decade of the 1980s, which we already discussed just a minute or two ago, the CIA provided guns and opium provided the finance for a guerrilla war that drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan. Let's turn now to a brief analysis of the other Afghan wars the U.S. has been involved in. First, the Civil War of the 1990s, and next, the ongoing counterinsurgency campaign we're fighting against the Taliban. After the U.S. and the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan in 1992, ruthless local warlords combined guns and opium in a brutal struggle for power that continued to ravage the land, destroying orchards, herds, irrigation, and seed stocks. When Pakistan's surrogate warlord, a man named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the heroin trafficker I mentioned earlier, failed to take power after a brutal bombardment of Kabul that killed 50,000 people, Pakistan's inner service intelligence armed a new force called the Taliban that captured Kabul in September 1996 and then fought the Northern Alliance for the next 5 years in the valley to the north of the capital. During this protracted civil war, rival factions used opium to finance the fighting, doubling the opium harvest from 2,000 tons in 1990 to a record 4,600 tons by 1999. Through this 20-fold jump in drug production during these two decades of warfare, Afghanistan was transformed from a diverse agricultural system into the world's first opium monocrop. Beneath the surface of this sudden change lurked a fragile ecological balance of field crops, orchard, and herding that could not recover unaided from decades of unprecedented devastation. Opium's attributes sustained this ravaged economy and saved the rural population from mass starvation. Since opium poppy requires 9 times more labor per hectare than the staple crop wheat, opium offered seasonal employment for approximately a quarter of the country's labor force in 1999. Opium merchants could accumulate capital quickly from the traffic to give poppy farmers crop loans critical to the survival of many poor villages. And Afghanistan's climate, which is not really very good for anything agriculture, just happens to be absolutely ideal for opium. And the average yield per hectare was 3 to 5 times higher than the chief illicit rival, Burma. After taking power in 1996, the Taliban, recognizing these realities, encouraged a nationwide expansion of opium cultivation, sanctioned the introduction of heroin manufacture, and they doubled production to that record 4,600 tons in 1999, then equivalent to about 75% of the world's heroin supply. But in July 2000, the Taliban's Mullah Omar ordered a sudden ban on opium cultivation in a desperate bid for international recognition. And overnight, They cut the harvest by 94% to only 185 metric tons in 2001. And that was actually in the Northern Alliance zone beyond the Taliban's control. But by then, Afghanistan had become an opium monocrop, dependent on poppy production for most of its taxes, export income, and employment. Thus, the Taliban's opium ban was an act of economic suicide that brought an already weakened society to the brink of collapse. When the U.S. invaded in October 2001, the Taliban regime was already a hollow shell that simply imploded at the burst of the first U.S. bombs. The outbreak of war with Washington in September 2001 ended the Taliban's opium ban. To defeat the Taliban, the CIA paid $70 million in bundles of $100 bills to mobilize the former warlords long active in the heroin trade to seize towns and cities across eastern Afghanistan, creating ideal conditions for the revival of the drug traffic. Within weeks after the Taliban's fall, officials reported an outburst of poppy planting in two heroin heartlands, Nangarhar in the east and the area around Kandahar in the south. After investing some $3 billion in Afghanistan's destruction during the Cold War, Washington and its allies now proved parsimonious in its reconstruction. Consequently, during the first year of U.S. occupation, Afghanistan's opium harvest surged extraordinarily from 185 tons to 3,400 tons in 1 year. Amazing. Boom. Over the next 5 years, international opium donors, by my calculation, gave $8 billion to rebuild Afghanistan. But opium infused nearly twice that amount, an estimated $14 billion, directly into the rural economy without any deductions by Kabul's bloated bureaucracy. As opium production continued its relentless rise, Washington ignored the problem, outsourcing narcotics control to Great Britain and police training to Germany. In 2007, the UN reported that the country's opium crop covered nearly 200,000 hectares, an area larger than all the cocoa fields in Latin America. It yielded 8,200 tons of opium. This represented 53%, half of Afghanistan's gross domestic product, and 93% of the world's heroin supply. Now, I say 53% of the country's gross domestic product, that means, well, not much to us, it's a number. What does that mean? Okay, in the 1980s, at the peak of the cocaine cartels, when the Justice Palace was assaulted, when the Secretero assassins were roaming the country, when the land is ripped apart by the cocaine cartels, cocaine accounted for 3%, 1-3% of Colombia's GDP, gross domestic product. Afghanistan's 53%. It's an opium monocrop, a drug monocrop, like none other that's ever existed in human history. Indeed, opium's influence is so pervasive that all Afghan political actors, rural warlords, the Taliban, and government officials have been tainted by this traffic, crippling the government and everyone else with corruption. The rural warlords who control the traffic are protected from prosecution by their alliance with the U.S. military or the CIA, notably the president's brother, Ahmed Walid Karzai, who was, until his recent assassination, local warlord, opium broker, and agency asset all rolled up into one. In January 2009, U.S. intelligence finally woke up to the problem and estimated that drug traffic provided the Taliban insurgents with nearly $500 million a year. Clearly, said Defense Secretary Robert Gates, we have to go after the drug labs and the drug lords that provide support to the Taliban and other insurgents. Frustrated by the failure of conventional anti-drug methods, in August 2009, the Obama administration ordered the U.S. military to kill or capture 50 Taliban-connected drug lords named on a classified kill list. Now, since that record crop of 2007, opium production declined to 4,000 tons in 2010, still representing over 90% of world heroin supply and a major source of funds for the Taliban. Let's reflect very briefly. In this ancient land, sown with dragon's teeth, we are locked into an endless cycle of drugs and death. Every spring in these rugged mountains, the snows melt, the opium seeds sprout, and a fresh crop of Taliban fighters paid from the drug profits take to the field to be gunned down by lethal American fire. And the next year, the snows melt again, fresh poppy shoots break through the soil, and a new crop of teenage Taliban fighters, needing jobs, takes to the field to fight against America. As the U.S. plans to withdraw from Afghanistan by 2014, we are likely to leave behind a corrupt government in Kabul, powerful drug lords who control the countryside, and a resilient Taliban insurgency fueled by illicit opium, an ambiguous legacy of bungled foreign policy and the CIA's long history of realpolitik alliances with drug lords. Thank you.